Ugh, now broadcasting in English.
Hello and welcome to Radio Prague's weekend program with me, Jan Richter. Coming up in today's show, in Czech books, David Vaughan has another installment of the captivating memoirs of a Lidice survivor. Then we visit the West Bohemian Chateau Kozel, and later we bring back our popular miniseries from the archives, so please stay tuned for all of that. We have now reached the sixth part in our serialized reading of If I Had Been a Boy, I Would Have Been Shot, the memoirs of Jaroslava Skleničková. Veronika Higgs has been reading the story of Jaroslava's childhood in Lidice, brought to a violent end in June 1942, when the Nazis decided to wipe away any trace of the village. Jaroslava, or Jaří, is the youngest of the women of Lidice to be sent to the Ravensbrück concentration camp, and she is there with her mother and sister, Mila. Nobody dares to think about what might have happened to the men and the children of the village. David Vaughan brings us the story so far.
The women of Lidice have been in Ravensbrück for over 2 years, and some have succumbed to illness, overwork, or have been transported to the death camps in Poland. But rumours are growing that Germany is losing the war. As the Eastern Front approaches, there is a growing sense of panic among the camp guards. Supply lines are beginning to be broken, and the camp regime is tightening. The most dangerous phase of Jaří's stay in Ravensbrück is about to begin. Veronika Higgs reads.
The Death March. From the end of 1944, large numbers of women prisoners were coming from concentration camps in Poland and eastern Germany. Typhus started to spread throughout the cramped camp. Supplies were slow in coming, and so we got smaller and smaller portions of bread. From the beginning of 1945, parcels and letters from home ceased to arrive. As one of the last of all, came a parcel from the director of the tuberculosis sanatorium in Vamberg, whom we knew from the Tatras. The parcel contained a box of smelly cheese from Olomouc. Even without bread, we ate it with enjoyment. As of the spring, because of the rapidly approaching front, work outside the camp was stopped, and for the same reason, work was interrupted in the tailor's workshops. Mila moved back to our barrack. At that time, a gas chamber was built in haste beside the camp, and with it came terrible selections. First of all, women from the hospital blocks, who were suffering from tuberculosis or typhus, were taken. Then all the momentarily unemployed women had to walk along Lagrovka, the main street, before the SS doctor. The reasons for the transfer to the special barrack, encircled in barbed wire, was any sign of tiredness, age over 50, varicose veins, or grey hair. Some of the women tried to darken their hair with anything that came to hand, even coal. In the same way, women on whom experimental operations had been performed were to be disposed of. Thanks to the solidarity of the Polish women and other inmates, these little rabbits were given the evidence number of someone who had died, instead of their original number, which was in the files, and thus they were saved. Because all the barracks were now overcrowded, a huge tent was hastily erected as an alternative solution. The first to be housed in it was a numerous transport of Hungarian Jewish women. To give some idea of the conditions that existed at the time in the camp, beautiful black leather boots were being offered for a tiny slice of bread, but without any success. It was then, too, that we still managed to see, for the last time, our auntie. Mama's sister. She was picked out during selection. She stood beyond the wires, and we could not get to her any more. She was very weak, and with a clouded, distracted look. She said not a word. She seemed not to recognize us. I handed her a piece of bread, and that was all I could do for her. On Good Friday, the gas chamber was used for killing, for the last time. After that, it was quickly pulled down, because at the beginning of April, a visit was expected from the International Red Cross Organization, which was partially to take over the evacuation of the concentration camp. In addition to the gas chamber, the overseers and the SS were destroying documents related to the operation of the camp, and it was only thanks to the Polish inmates and their organization that many of these documents were saved, hidden, and eventually taken out of the camp. The first to leave the camp were Norwegian women. After a few days, buses of the International Red Cross Organization came again and gradually carried away the French, English, Dutch, Belgian, Jewish, and some of the Polish women. The Russian front was rapidly drawing nearer, and we were expecting to be liberated soon. We envisaged how wonderful it would be when we went out of the gates in freedom. Each of us had prepared a secretly made small pack containing a small piece of hard bread and our personal souvenirs. And then the Lager Commandant, commander of the camp, issued an order that the camp must be evacuated within 24 hours. And so, every 2 hours, a large transport of women prisoners left the camp, those who were capable of walking. At the same time, a rumour was spreading amongst us that after the departure of the last transport, the whole area would be blown up. On the second day, the 28th of April, another transport was prepared in the morning. It comprised a large group of Czech women. My mamma, sister and I left the camp in this transport. With us, they carried off the sewing machines on lorries. Perhaps the Germans still believed that the front would stop. In rows of five, we marched off to the west, to the concentration camp at Malchow. Of course, it was difficult to march with wooden clogs on our feet, and the guards grew mad, and our slow progress made them furious. We marched the whole day without a rest and covered about 40 kilometres. It was nearing midnight when we were permitted to rest for 3 hours near a wood. For the journey, each of us had received a parcel of food from the American Red Cross, which the SS had so far kept for themselves. Sad to say, our stomachs could not master anything from the parcels, except a roll of biscuits. But then again, that was the only thing of value left to us for exchange. Later, I managed to make a wonderful deal. For 20 Camel cigarettes, I got a box of matches. The next day, we passed through the little town of Miro and got onto a main road filled with vehicles evacuating German civilians from Poland, as well as North and East Germany, prisoners of war, inmates, all in a single stream, hurried in the same direction, to the northwest, to the Americans. Beyond the little town in the afternoon, we rested a while. Just then, suddenly, two planes were circling innocently over us. When they came lower, we realized they were dive bombers. They started shooting. People were trying to run away in all directions. One rebounding shot wounded a horse, who pulled himself away from the cart and started running wildly along the road. 5 French prisoners threw their national flag on their cart. The pilots noticed it and stopped shooting. We continued marching until we reached the airport in Rechlin, about which we knew from other prisoners that it was often the target for bombardment. Mama, my sister and I kept close together, so that, in case of a raid, we would die together. We could not bear to think that just one of us would be left lying there. Initially, we were to spend the second night of our march near Rechlin, but it was too dangerously close to the airfield. So we kept on marching till night time, and camped behind the barn of a solitary farm. An icy wind was blowing. It was cold, and we were all very tired. When the next day we crossed the square of the small town, the lower window of one of the houses opened, and an elderly woman held in her hands a pot of perhaps tea, and wanted to give us a drink. However, before any of us could put a cup under the pot, our rough and permanently drunk guard rushed to the window, shouted at the woman, and asked if she knew whom she was offering the drink. "They're the biggest of criminals." With that, the woman quickly closed the window and pulled the curtains together. The guards forced us along at such a pace that we caught up with the transport that had left Ravensbrück several hours before us. In it were many women from Lidice, and we learned from them that their overseers were milder than ours. Among them was Mrs. Buchmeltrova, who called to Mama, "Mrs. Sukhankova, come over here. Take your scarves off your heads, sit down, and behave as if you belong to our group." Thus we managed to mix among them. As we were drawing near to the little town of Malchow, the first rows were approached by the guard to give further instructions and to designate the way to go. She then went to the rear, from which she could better control our movement. We had not reached the town square when we realized that all our guards had disappeared. We divided ourselves according to nationality. We, Czech women, elected as our leader Miladka Shimchikova, who, being a teacher, spoke German well. We set out again, but we were not going to another concentration camp. We spent the night in a nearby forest, for the first time without anybody supervising us. The next day, we cooked a festive dinner. Along the way, we'd found a dead horse, which had been partly skinned. Meat was for us a great rarity, and when we'd also found a silo of potatoes, the result was an excellent goulash, cooked over a campfire.
David Warne with that edition of Czech Books. You're listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio, where we now visit the West Bohemian Chateau Kozel with Jan Wellinger.
One of the best-kept secrets among Czech castles and historic sites is the gorgeous Kozel Chateau, founded in the late 18th century in western Bohemia. Founded by nobleman Jan Wojciech Czernin, a member of Emperor Joseph II's court, the stone residence served as an exquisite hunting chateau, and today is one of the best examples of classicist architecture in Bohemia. The site is surrounded by fine lawns, a beautiful park, and forests perfect for visits in the spring and summer. What's more, Kozel is only an hour away from Prague, and just mere minutes away from nearby Pilsen. Jaroslava Ulčová has been a guide at Kozel for almost 10 years.
To si kolikrát tu otázku klademe také. Já si myslím, že byť je to jenom v uvozovkách.
We often ask ourselves what it is that makes Kozel special. Although it's only in quotation marks a hunting chateau, it is atypical in having such beautiful interiors. This is something really enjoyed by visitors. We're not Karlstein, but we hold our own. We get some 150,000 visitors per season.
Většinou, když lidé odchází, tak si to strašně chválí.
The nobleman Jan Wojciech Czernin was influenced by the French philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau, says the guide, stressing that the idea of a return to nature left a grand impression on the nobility. A country seat like Kozel Chateau represented in many ways not only an idyll, but an idealized view of country life. The exteriors were austere, even strict. The chateau was made up only of a ground floor. But within, heavily decorated interiors designed by the painter Antonín Tuvora. The rooms often reveal floral motifs in the Rococo style or serene scenes from nature, as well as mythological figures. Each of the rooms served a particular purpose for staff, for guest nobility, and the owner's personal quarters, the hunting room and more. All have been perfectly preserved. Jaroslava Ulčová again.
Vlastně tady vepředu, to severní křídlo, jak jsme vešli, to bylo určené pro služebnictvo.
When you enter through the main entrance, the front wing was originally for the servants, the side wings were for the guests, and the back, the double rooms, were for the owners. Two-thirds of the furniture at Kozel are original pieces. One-third was brought from other sites, but are also historic items. After 1945, when the chateau was nationalized, and after the communist takeover in 1948, many castles in the country were plundered, and often items were sold off for a pittance. Even here, luckily, Kozel was not badly hit.
Já vždycky lidem říkám, že jsme ještě rádi, že nám tu vůbec něco zbylo a že nám toho tu zbylo ještě dost.
Furniture in the chateau ranges from the Baroque to Rococo and Louis XVI, or Classicist style, as well as Empire, with Egyptian motifs from Sphinx paws to Stoic female forms that were the rage during the age of Napoleon. Many of the rooms are stunning. Each, by the way, features its own tiled stove for heating, for good reason.
Žádné skoro místnosti nesmějí chybět kamna.
Every room needed its own heating. It is, after all, a stone building. Visitors come in the summer in their t-shirts and shorts, but I always tell them to take note of what the guide is wearing. Sometimes it gets so cool you could put on furs. The heating was important when you consider the décolleté or low neckline that was the fashion for noble women at the time the chateau was built.
Takže ta kamna pro ty dekolty těch dám byla určitě nutná.
So what about the rooms? Well, all are memorable. An entrance hall into the owner's quarters featuring painted motifs of fake stone and vine. A room for guests showing portraits of children, members of the nobility long forgotten. The original owner, Jan Wojciech Czernin, never had children of his own, but later owners from the Wallenstein family had many. For them too, Kozel Chateau was likely a remarkable place. Guide Jaroslava Ulčová again.
Czernin never had children, but the Wallensteins had many, and there is even a kind of log cabin or small cottage near here that was specially built for them. The kids probably enjoyed this country home the way we enjoy our own cottages today.
One room in the chateau, a former stable under Czernin, was used by the later owners as a personal theater. Once lit by candles and later oil lamps, it's tiny but magical, featuring a small stage with many props.
To bylo skutečně jenom rodinné divadelko, kdy se tady hrálo při třeba soukromně, ano.
It was a theater used only by the family for personal and private events, Christmas and Easter, or when the children wanted to put on plays. No professional ever performed here. It was strictly a family affair. The family, a la Marie Antoinette, would dress up like commoners and play at being country folk. Or the children simply would put together performances for their parents.
Nebo děti připravili něco pro své rodiče, pro známé a podobně.
No hunting chateau would be complete without a huntsman's room, including a number of racked firearms and mounted trophies, although by comparison to other castles, the number of those here is fairly modest. For the nobility, there was also a billiards room. A large Russian table is found in the center. The set featured not only billiard balls, but also mysterious objects that were once used in the game and later lost. Our guide informs us the rules remain unknown, also lost among dozens of different variants. Another room features this music box, which, believe it or not, plays a variation on the Marseillaise. Marseille as they're in that old music box. So, Gozel Chateau is highly recommended for a day trip. Not an obvious pick for tourists, but a site that has made it onto numerous best of lists. Gozel means billy goat in Czech. It may not sound attractive, but it is. And where does the original name come from?
Tady na tom vrchu, kdysi dávno naši pohané vždycky v době jarní roky.
The top of the hill where the chateau lies was a sacrificial site in pagan times. During the spring equinox, it was common practice to sacrifice a billy goat here to the pagan gods. The name stuck, although it wasn't used by the owners, but it was revived after the war.
Ten původní název, historický, tak jak si to lidi tady vlastně pojmenovali česky.
That edition of Spotlight by Jan Wellinger was first broadcast in July 2009. Coming up next, a rerun of our popular series From the Archives by David Vaughan.
The wartime president of occupied Bohemia and Moravia, Emil Hácha, is one of the saddest figures of Czech 20th century history. An elderly academic, he only agreed reluctantly to become head of state after Edvard Beneš resigned over the Munich Agreement in 1938. He made the tragic mistake of remaining in office when Hitler marched into the country 6 months later. Hácha's hopes of preserving at least some of his country's independence were gradually worn down. And as his health failed, he eventually became nothing but a puppet of the Gestapo. On March the 15th, 1944, to mark the fifth anniversary of the occupation, President Hácha delivered a speech on Prague radio. It was only meant to be a brief message. But by then Hácha was already sick and broken, scarcely able even to play the grotesque ceremonial role he had been left by the Nazis. The radio reporters who went up to the castle to record the speech had a great deal more difficulty than they expected. The entire tape of what was recorded is preserved, including several failed attempts by the ailing Hácha to speak coherently. On several occasions, his voice breaks down completely. At this point, the radio reporter, Josef Stinsibus, interrupts the president. Cautiously, he asks if he would mind reading it again. That was fine, Stinsibus says diplomatically. But perhaps, Mr. President, it would be a good idea to read it again, a little louder, and as if you really felt what you were saying. The reporter goes on to demonstrate by reading a couple of sentences himself. This bizarre scene is repeated on several occasions, until, on the 11th attempt, the final version is recorded. The speech goes as follows. Dear fellow citizens, 5 years is not a long time in the life of a nation, but enough to destroy it for several generations. We have seen this in the example of some other small nations. Sometimes there is only a moment between the path of life and the path of death. It was at one such moment that we decided our future lay with the Greater German Reich. Since that time, we have faced many obstacles, but we have managed to remain intact. I can even see that we are a nation that is rising in its inner value. This is the most important proof that we followed the right path. I ask you all to continue under all circumstances to be faithful to this country's leaders, to the Reich, whose victory will bring you and your children a happy future. May God's goodwill never leave us. But the days of the Reich were already numbered. Less than a week after the end of the war, on May the 13th, 1945, Emil Hácha was arrested at the presidential castle in Lány and put into Prague's Pankrác prison. He died 2 weeks later, on June the 27th.
That edition of From the Archives by David Warren brings us to the end of today's show. We're always happy to get your comments and questions, so do get in touch. The address is Vinohradská 12, 12099 Prague 2. You can also send us an email, of course, at english@radio.cz. I'm Jan Richter. From all of us here at Radio Prague, thank you very much for joining us, and goodbye.
vous écoutez Radio